Okay. With that said, we're now going to turn to strategies of outrage management. And you're now in the second section of the handbook of the handouts. And if you look at the first page of that section, it should be, if all is going well, it should be strategies of outrage management is the yellow page, and the first page is reducing outrage, six principal strategies. We are going to focus on those six strategies for several hours. Those of you who are unhappy that we will only be talking about six strategies, if you turn the page, the next several pages are about additional strategies. And if you look down at the bottom, you can see down at the bottom under for more on my take on this issue, the URL for an article called A Laundry List of 50 Outrage Reducers. If you want more than six outrage management strategies, they are readily available to you in the handouts and on the website. But frankly, I'm going to be lucky if I can get through six in the allotted time. So I'm not going to try to get through more than six. Although these are called in the handout strategies for reducing outrage in ways that were already implied by one of the comments that got made, these are also strategies for preventing outrage. You know, if you are in the lower left-hand corner of the map, outrage is currently low, but you anticipate that it's going to be high. These are the same things you do in that situation as in a situation where there's already outrage. It's just harder. It's hard enough when the outrage is palpable, and it's internally very hard when the outrage is not yet palpable to persuade your organization to use these strategies. But they work. They work more efficiently for outrage prevention than for outrage reduction. Okay. And the first of the six that we're going to talk about is to stake out the middle rather than the extreme. In any controversy between the position that X is incredibly dangerous and the position that X is perfectly safe, incredibly dangerous always wins. But in a controversy between incredibly dangerous and moderately dangerous stands a very good chance of winning. Now, in that sense, risk communication simply is not a level playing field. A neutral strategic advisor, which is what I am, brought in by an activist group and asked, how can we increase the outrage? Advise us on how to get people more outraged. Would advise, among other things, exaggerate. The more you exaggerate how bad this is, the more outrage you'll get. There are limits. You know, if you go too far, you'll lose credibility. If you go too far, you might even have legal problems. But by and large, if you are trying to alarm people, they allow you considerable leeway to exaggerate how bad the situation is. If, on the other hand, that same consultant is brought in by a company and asked, how can we reduce the outrage? Or if there's not much yet, how can we prevent outrage? The consultant would advise, among other things, don't exaggerate. If you exaggerate how safe this is, if you exaggerate how good the situation is, the exaggeration will backfire and the outrage will go up instead of down. Okay. And, you know, another way of putting this is it takes ethics for activists not to exaggerate because it works for them. It shouldn't take ethics for industry not to exaggerate. Intelligence should be sufficient. Okay. Or to put it yet another way, let's assume you're doing a B-minus job of managing the problem, whatever the problem is, you're doing a B-minus job of managing it. Your critics unfairly give you an F. You give yourself an A. And the public, when it finds out, flunks you for cheating. Public is not particularly upset that your critics gave you a worse grade than you deserve, but it's very upset that you gave yourself a better grade than you deserve. So what you need to do is fight the F with the B minus you actually deserve instead of the A you are tempted to claim. Now, some of you are looking at me like, that's not fair. You know, and you're right, it's not fair. I apologize on behalf of the universe for being asymmetrical. But the reality is the universe is asymmetrical. Every role has its own assets and liabilities. You know, one of the advantages of being an activist is you get to exaggerate. One of the advantages of working for industry is you get well paid. And, you know, you get to pick the package you like, but you don't always get to mix and match. If you want the pleasures of exaggeration, you have to go work in a situation where you're trying to get people more upset. And whenever you're trying to get people more upset, whenever you're trying to increase outrage, exaggeration is a tool in your toolkit. Don't overuse it. Don't, you know, don't go too far. Don't go off the deep end. But it's a legitimate tool in your toolkit. If you are trying to reduce outrage, exaggeration has no place in your toolkit. So all battles, if they are well fought, are battles between one extreme and the middle. And, you know, the alarming side is pretty extreme, and the reassuring side is on the middle. If you can seduce them into the middle with you so that it's competing shades of gray, you're in very good shape. If they can seduce you into the opposite extreme, so it's their extreme versus your extreme, they are in very good shape. If you know what you're doing, you'll stay in the middle. If they know what they're doing, they'll stay on the extreme. That's where each side has its maximum competitive advantage. Okay, I want to make sure everybody understands what's symmetrical here and what is not symmetrical here. Okay. The first thing that's symmetrical is, in fact, everybody exaggerates. Okay. Nobody lies. Lying is surprisingly rare. Lying is kind of old-fashioned. It's very 19th century. It's like twirling your mustaches and tying maidens to railroad tracks. It's not done much anymore. The reason we don't lie is we have PR people. Okay, and I assume you know what I'm talking about, and I'll give the PR people in the room a chance to rebut if they think I'm wrong, but let me describe the situation. You have a meeting to look at a document, and somebody points to a paragraph and says, "We can't say that." And the person who wrote the draft says, "Well, why not? It gives the impression we want to give." And the critic says, "Well, yeah, but it's just flat not true." So it's revised. And there's another meeting. And someone points to the same paragraph that's been revised and says, "We can't say that." And the person who wrote the draft says, "Well, why not? It's true." And the person criticizing it says, "Well, yeah, but it doesn't give the impression we want to give." And now the task is clear. The task is to give the impression of the first draft without actually lying. Okay. And that's why it takes 11 drafts. You know, it only takes one draft to tell the truth. It only takes one draft to lie. But it takes 11 drafts to mislead. Okay. And that's why all your documents take 11 drafts, because what you're trying to do typically is not lie, but give the misimpression you want to give, the half-truth that you want to sell. Okay? And you do that, and activists do that, and government does that. Everybody does that. Okay. Is there anyone who disagrees? Okay, that's the first thing that's symmetrical. Okay. The second thing that's symmetrical is everybody judges their own distortions on a different ethical metric than other people's distortions. Okay. For a very good reason, because you know the truth with a capital T. And when you mislead people toward the truth, you are misleading toward the truth, it doesn't feel to you like you're misleading at all. Those facts that you're leaving out or distorting would have misled people. That's why you left them out. Okay? You are, you know, so you don't see yourself as misleading. You see yourself as leading. Okay. Your opponents look at what you're doing. They don't think you're misleading either. They think you're lying. Okay. You're not lying. You went through through 11 drafts struggling not to lie. You really aren't lying. It's terribly unfair to say you're lying, but you also aren't leading. You are misleading. Okay. Now, they do exactly the same thing, but they have the opposite truth. So they leave out or distort different facts. And they see themselves as leading, not misleading. And you see them as lying. Okay. But in fact, They are doing exactly what you are doing. As a consultant, I work for industry, I work for government, I work for activists, I will work for anyone. And I haven't seen a nickel's... Except I will, that's right, I won't work for the tobacco industry. The only product I know that when it's used properly kills millions of people. So I at least I draw a line somewhere. But I will work for virtually anybody, even, you know, you. I've had an opportunity to see all sides, and I don't see much difference. Nobody lies. Everybody misleads. Everybody gives themselves permission to mislead because they're misleading in the direction they consider good for the world. And everybody gives their opponents no slack at all, not because they're misleading, but because they're misleading in the wrong direction. Okay. All of that is symmetrical. Here's the thing that's not symmetrical. Works for them, backfires on you. Okay. That is, when you are distorting in the ways I'm talking about, in an alarmist direction, you get away with it. When you're distorting in a reassuring direction, you get crucified for it. They should therefore continue to do it, and you should stop. Okay. There's a very good reason for that asymmetry, and it's conservativeness. You'll remember when I defined risk, I talked about the fact that it becomes not just the multiplication of our best guess at magnitude times our best guess at probability, but our conservative guess at magnitude times our conservative guess at probability. We put our thumb on the scales. We consciously overestimate the risk in order to be sure we're protecting people enough. This is a different kind of conservativeness. If a smoke alarm goes off and there's no fire, that's a minor problem. If there's a fire and the smoke alarm doesn't go off, that's a major problem. So we calibrate smoke alarms to go off too much so they won't miss a fire. Okay. We similarly calibrate NGOs to go off too much so they won't miss a problem. So if you ask people, does Greenpeace exaggerate, they'll say yes. And if you say, is that a problem, they'll say no, that's their job. Okay. And then you ask them, does Rio Tinto exaggerate, they'll say yes. And you say, is that a problem, they'll say, damn right, yeah, they ought to throw those bastards in jail. Okay. And it simply isn't symmetrical. Exaggeration in the service of warning people is a public service. Exaggeration in the service of reassuring people is a public disservice. So warnings can be exaggerated and reassurances can't. You need to stake out the middle. They get to rebut your crap. Now, what does that mean in practice? What does staking out the middle mean in practice? It means you figure out what your critics' good arguments are and you include them in your own communications. Hey, include your own good arguments too. I'm not saying you argue their case instead of yours. What you're doing is arguing their case as well as yours. They are not doing that. They are arguing their case, period. You are arguing both cases. And if I can think of a good argument, a sound argument, an accurate claim that works against you, and it's not in your communications, you're not doing the job right. Your goal is to leave your critics nothing to say except things you have already admitted and things that are flat-out lies. Okay. Now, that's very hard to do. There are at least three barriers. The first barrier is intellectual. You have to know which of your critics' claims are crap and which of your critics' claims have at least a germ of truth. I have a lot of clients who can't tell. I worked for another mining company some years ago in Indonesia, and they were under attack by an activist group called WALI, the dominant environmental group in Indonesia. And they decided that they would try to do what I was recommending and stake out the middle and acknowledge WALI's true claims. There was nobody in the company who knew which of WALI's claims had any truth to them. They had drunk their own Kool-Aid. They had bought their own propaganda. And you know what I'm talking about, right? After 20 years during which anybody who ever said of WALI, well, they have a good point there, you know, that was not a good career move. People who said that tended not to get promoted. Okay, pretty soon, there's nobody left in the company who knows what WALI's good points are. And exactly the same thing can happen depending on your corporate culture, whether there's anyone in your company or in your part of the company, anyone in your at your site who knows which of your critics' arguments are sound. Okay. That's the first problem. The second problem is psychological and very obvious. Nobody likes sticking out the middle. We would all rather stand tall for our side. It's very unpleasant to stake out the middle. There's some evidence that the higher you rise in an organization, the more resistant you become to staking out the middle. Yes? Can you still hear me in the back without the mic? Yeah. Yes, you can. Okay. What was I talking about?
Middle ground.
Yes, thank you. There's some evidence that high-ranking people are more resistant to staking out the middle as they rise in the hierarchy, and you can kind of understand why that might be true. I mean, you know, low-ranking people go to a lot of meetings in which they acknowledge that other people have a good point. High-ranking people go to a lot of meetings in which people tell them that they have a good point. So they may get out of the habit of seeing other people's good points, or they may not. Again, it depends on your corporate culture. The third barrier is, I think, the most serious in most organizations, and it is the organizational barrier. Let's suppose you accept my advice. There's going to be a radio talk show next Tuesday, and you're going to go to that radio talk show. Your worst critic is also going to be at that radio talk show. We're going to call her Susan. Susan is my first wife's name, and I like using it for the bad guy. So Susan's going to be there, and I have advised you, don't rebut Susan's crap. Susan has a lot of crap. I like saying that. But don't rebut Susan's crap. Instead of rebutting Susan's crap, validate Susan's valid arguments, okay? And you've decided to do that. You're going to stake out the middle. You're going to acknowledge the ways in which Susan's right, okay? And I have argued that vis-a-vis the donkey game and vis-a-vis the seesaw game, that's the smart thing to do. It's bad, follow the leader, and you're willing to pay that price because the people who care matter more to you and are likelier to be listening to the talk show than the people who don't care. Okay, so you do it. What happens when you get back to the office? You're sacked, maybe. Or at least people look at you funny. Why were you washing the company's dirty linen in public? Why were you admitting all that stuff? Now, if you blindside everybody and you go do it without any forewarning, there's going to be a lot of internal outrage. So suppose you don't blindside everybody. We go to a meeting. We're all in a meeting, and we agree that you're going to go to that radio talk show next Tuesday, and you're going to acknowledge Susan's valid arguments. And you're at the meeting at which we agree that that's what he's going to do, and he does it. And when he comes back, you're still not happy with him. He still feels like a traitor to you, even though you were at the meeting. You didn't know he was going to sound so sincere. So this is a genuine problem. I mean, how you experience the problem depends on your rank. If you're a high-ranking person, high-ranking problem, that's right. If you're a high-ranking person, this is a morale problem. If you're a low-ranking person, this is a career problem. Okay? For most of us, it's both. It's a morale problem vis-a-vis the people who work for you or with you. It's a career problem vis-a-vis the people you work for and on up the hierarchy. I want to make a point very clear. There are things worth getting fired for in life. Good outrage management is not one of them. Okay. Good precaution advocacy is. If your company is killing people and hiding it, blow the whistle, get fired, it's worth it. Okay. But if your company is managing the hazard fine and doing a lousy job of managing the outrage, and you have learned at this seminar some better ways of managing the outrage, but your boss hasn't learned them or doesn't buy them and doesn't want you to do this stuff, in particular doesn't want you to stake out the middle, wants you to stand tall for the company, then go ahead and stand tall for the company. I don't want you to sacrifice your career to what's good for the company. There are two lessons here. I mean, one is before you implement my recommendations, check to see if your management is going to reward it or punish it. And the other implication is if you're senior management and you want people to implement these recommendations, start figuring out how you're going to communicate successfully and honestly that you are prepared to reward and not punish efforts to do good outrage management. You know, including in the example we're talking about now, going to a radio talk show and washing the company's dirty linen in public. Okay, so don't do that just because Sandman says it's a good idea. Wait till your boss thinks it's a good idea. Any comments about number one?
Does it change with time? I mean, in the absence of any other change, if you just leave things alone, will they not drift to the middle anyway?
Yes. If you leave, generally, as somebody pointed out earlier, generally outrage subsides. It may take, in the case of Aboriginals outraged at the horrible things that were done to them, it may take centuries, but outrage does eventually subside. It subsides more quickly if people find new things to be outraged at. Now, if they're your new things, that doesn't help you much. But if they're somebody else's new things, then then time is on your side. All of these strategies are grounded in the assumption that you don't want to wait that long, and you want to attract people toward a position of lower outrage at you, freeing up outrage to attach to somebody else earlier than they would in the normal passage of time. But you're absolutely right. If you just go about your business, it will subside. It's just that, if the outrage is costing you money, you don't want to go about your business. You want to reduce it.
Peter, if you let an outrage subside about a particular issue, and then later on another issue comes up, even if it was 20 years ago the outrage happened, isn't it, I find, that old outrage comes straight back into that forum?
Yes. In both directions. That is, old outrages make people more sensitive to new outrages. So if I'm still pissed off at you about those other things and you do something else, it will make me more outraged than it otherwise would have. I mean, anything BP does in the United States now that's even slightly wrong is going to generate huge outrage because of the spill. Yeah. So what you did before increases the outrage of the past. Outrage in the future, okay? But also, when something happens in the future, everybody looks backwards in time. It's never been easier, right? Everybody goes to Google and looks up all the other bad things you've done. So not only did the BP oil spill make future BP errors bigger outrages, it also made the explosion in Texas City a bigger outrage and the pipeline problems in Alaska a bigger outrage. They were in the past but got dredged up as sidebars to the oil spill story.